The light bloomed. The shape of the leopard hardened. Its hide turned to buttery gold, studded with black rosettes. Its tail swung gently like a metronome, set to its slowest beat. It lifted its head slightly and pricked its ears. The light caught its eyes, a flare of yellow like a distant flash of sheet lightning. It looked towards them and blinked sleepily in regal indolence, so beautiful that Shaza felt his chest squeezed for breath. It was time to make the kill. He touched Elsa, a light, imperative tap on her upper arm. She settled down behind the telescopic sight of the rifle. Shaza braced himself for the shot and stared at the leopard, willing the bullet into its heart, hoping to see it topple and tumble lifeless from the high branch. The seconds drew out, each of them a separate age. The shot did not come. The leopard rose to its full height, standing easily erect on the narrow branch. It stretched, arching its back deeply, digging its extended claws into the bark. "Now," Shaza commanded her silently, "shoot it now." The leopard yawned, its pink tongue curled out between the gaping fangs. Its thin black lips drew back into a fierce rictus. "Now!" With telepathic effort, Shaza tried to force her to make the shot. He dared not reinforce the command with a word or touch, for fear that he disturb her concentration in the very act of firing. The leopard straightened and flicked its tail over its back. Then, without further warning, it launched itself into flight and dropped from the branch 20 feet to the soft, mulched floor of the forest. It was a leap so controlled and graceful that there was no sound as it landed. The undergrowth swallowed it instantly. They sat for almost a minute in total silence. At last Elsa set the safety catch with a click and lowered the unfired rifle and turned her head towards him. In the dawn light, the tears shone like seed pearls on the long curled lashes of her lower lids.
"He was so beautiful," she whispered. "I could not kill him. Not today. Not on this day."
He understood instantly. This day was their day, their very first day together as lovers. She had declined to desecrate it.
"I dedicate the leopard to you," she said.
"You do me too much honour," he replied, and kissed her. Their embrace was strangely innocent, almost childlike, devoid as yet of sexual passion. It was a thing of the spirit rather than of the body. There would be time for that later, all the time in the world. But not today, not on this blessed day. Sean had made a miraculous recovery from his malaria and was waiting eagerly at the Boma Gate to welcome the returning hunters. The reputation of a safari company was built upon the quality of trophies it produced for its clients, especially for its important clients. As the Toyota pulled up, he glanced hopefully into the back, and his mouth tightened with disappointment. He spoke first to Matatu, and the little Indorobo tracker shook his head gloomily. "The devil came late and left early." "I'm sorry, Signora," Sean turned to her and handed her down from the truck. "That is hunting," she murmured, and he had never seen her so philosophical before. Usually she was as angry and as impatient with failure as he was. "Your shower is ready, hot as you like it. Breakfast will be waiting as soon as you have cleaned up." The rest of the party were full of condolences. When Shaza and Elsa appeared in the dining tent, both of them showered and shaved and dressed in freshly laundered and crisply ironed khaki. Shaza was shaved and redolent of aftershave lotion. "Bad luck, Pater. So sorry, Signora," they chorused, and were puzzled that the couple looked smug and self-satisfied and fell on their breakfast with as much gusto as if they were a world-record leopard in the skinning shed. "We can continue our meeting after breakfast," Gary suggested over coffee. "And I'll renew the baits this morning," Sean came in. "Matatu says the leopard was never alarmed or spooked. We can try again tonight. This time I'll hunt with you, Signora. It takes the touch of the master." Instead of accepting the suggestions immediately, Elsa glanced across at Shaza and then lowered her eyes demurely to her coffee cup. Well, actually, Sharza began, to tell the truth, we rather thought, that is, Elsa and I, rather, Signora Pignatelli and I, as Sharza floundered for words, all three of his brood stared at him in astonishment. Was this the master of savoir-faire? Was this Mr. Cool himself speaking?
Your father has promised to show me the Victoria Falls.
Elsa came to his rescue, and Sharza looked relieved and rallied gamely. We'll take the Beechcraft, he agreed briskly. Signora Pignatelli has never seen the falls. This seems like a good opportunity. The other members of the family recovered from their confusion as rapidly as Sharza had. Well, that's a lovely idea, Isabella enthused. It's the most awe-inspiring spectacle, Signora. You'll adore it. It's only an hour's flight, Gary nodded. You could have lunch at the Vic Falls Hotel and be back here for tea. And you can still be ready to go into the leopard hide at 4 this afternoon, Sean agreed, and waited expectantly for agreement from his client. Once again Elsa glanced at Sharza, and he drew a deep breath. Actually, we may stay over at the Vic Falls Hotel for a day or two. Slowly, various degrees of comprehension dawned on the three young faces. Quite right. You'll need time, Isabella recovered first. You'll want to walk in the rainforest, perhaps take a raft trip down the gorge below the falls. Bella is right. You'll need 3 or 4 days. So many interesting things to do and see. That, Gary, old boy, is the understatement of the week, Sean drawled, and both Gary and Isabella glared at him furiously. In the cool, clean air, not yet sullied by the smoke of the bushfires of the late winter season, the spray cloud of the Victoria Falls was visible at 60 miles distance. It rose 2,000 feet into the sky, a silver mountain as brilliant as an alp of snow. Sharza shed altitude as they approached. Ahead of them the great Zambezi glinted in the sun, broad and tranquil, studded by its islands on which the forests of graceful ivory nut palms stood giraffe-necked. Then the main gorge opened beneath them, and they peered down in wonder as they watched the great river, well over a mile wide, tumble over the sheer edge of the chasm and fall 350 feet in a welter of foaming waters and blown spray. Along the brink of the chasm, black castles of rock split the flow of the river. Over it all towered the immense spray cloud, which was shot through with rainbows of astonishing colour. Below the falls, the entire flood of the river, a staggering 38,000 cubic feet a second, was trapped between vertical cliffs of rock and charged, raging at this restraint, into the narrow throat of the gorge. Sharza banked the aircraft into a tight right-hand turn, pointing one wing into the abyss so that Elsa could gaze down with her view unobstructed. With each circuit he allowed the Beechcraft to drop lower, until they were in danger of being engulfed by the splendid chaos of rock and water. The silver leaping spray blew over the canopy, blinding them for an instant, before they burst once more into the sunlight and the rainbows garlanded the sky around them. Sharza landed at the small private airfield of Sprayview, on the outskirts of the village, and taxied to the hard stand. He switched off the engines and turned to Elsa. The wonder of it was still in her eyes, and her expression was solemn, with an almost religious awe. "Now you have worshipped the Cathedral of Africa," Sharza told her softly. "The one place that truly embodies all of the grandeur and mystery and savagery of this continent." They were fortunate enough to find the Livingston suite at the hotel vacant. The building was in the style and dimensions of a bygone era. The walls were thick and the rooms immense, but cool and comfortable. The suite was decorated with prints of the drawings that the old explorer Thomas Baines had made of the falls only a few years after David Livingston first discovered them. From the windows of their sitting room they looked across the gorge and the railway bridge that spanned it. The steelwork of the arched bridge seemed delicate as lace, and the entire structure was light and graceful as the wing of an eagle in flight. They left the suite and wandered down the pathway to the brink of the gorge, and walked hand in hand through the rainforest, where the spray fell in an eternal soaking rain, and the vegetation was green and luxuriant. The rock trembled beneath their feet, and the air was filled with the thunder of the falling waters. The spray soaked their clothing and their hair, and ran down their faces, and they laughed together with the joy of it. They followed the rim of the gorge downstream, out of the spray cloud. The bright sunshine dried their hair and clothing almost as swiftly as the spray had drenched them. They found a rocky perch on the very edge and sat side by side, dangling their legs over the terrifying chasm, while the mad waters churned into green whirlpools far below. "Look!" Sharza cried, and pointed upwards, as a small bird of prey stooped out of the sun and fell on whistling knife-blade wings into the flock of black swifts that swirled along the cliff face below them. "A tighter falcon!" Sharza exulted. "One of the rarest birds in Africa." The falcon struck one of the swifts in flight, killing it instantly in a burst of feathers. Then, binding to its prey, fell into the void and disappeared from their view in the gloom far below. That evening they dined on steaks of crocodile tail that tasted like lobster. But when they went up to the suite, they were suddenly both shy and nervous. Sean drank a cognac in the sitting room. When finally he went through into the bedroom, Elsa was already propped up on the pillows. Her hair was down on the shoulders of her lace nightdress, and it was thick and black and glossy. Sharza was overcome by a sense of panic. He was no longer young, and there had been one or two occasions recently with other women which had shaken his confidence. She smiled and lifted her arms to him in invitation. He need not have worried. She manned him as no other woman ever had. In the morning, when they awoke in each other's arms, the sun was streaming in through the high windows. She sighed and smiled with a slow and languorous contentment, and said, "My man," and kissed him. Their illicit honeymoon drew out from one day to the next. They did things together, silly little things, for which for many years Sharza had had neither the time nor the inclination. They slept late each morning, and then spent the rest of it loafing in their swimming costumes beside the pool. They read for hours in companionable silence, stretched out in the sunlight. At intervals they anointed each other with suntan oil, making it a fine excuse to touch and examine each other in leisurely detail. Elsa was lean and smooth and tanned. The condition and tone of her muscle and skin were the rewards for endless hours of aerobics and calisthenics and beauty care. She was obviously proud of her body. Sharza came to share that pride as he compared her to the other semi-naked bodies sunning themselves under the masasa trees on the green lawns. Only up very close were the stigmata that life and childbirth had left upon her visible. Sharza found even those small blemishes appealing. They emphasized her maturity and bespoke her experience and understanding of life. She was a woman, ripe and complete. This was made even more apparent when they talked. They talked for hours at a time. These were lazy, contented conversations during which they explored each other's mind in the same way they had explored each other's body in the double bed upstairs in the Livingston suite. She told him about herself with an engaging candour. She described Bruno's slow, cruel death as the crab of cancer ate him alive, and her own agony as she watched helplessly. She spoke of the loneliness that followed, 7 long years of it. She did not have to tell him that she hoped that was now behind her. She merely reached out and touched his hand, and it was understood. She told him of her children, a son also named Bruno, and 3 daughters. 2 of the girls were married. The youngest was at university in Milano, and Bruno Jr. was an MBA from Harvard, now working for Pignatelli Industries in Rome. "He does not have his father's fire," she told Sharza frankly. "I do not think he will ever fill those shoes. They are many sizes too large for him." She made Sharza think of his own sons. They spoke of the heartaches and disappointments that their children had brought them, and of the rare joys that some had bestowed upon them. They explored together their loves of horses and hunting, of music and art, and fine things lovingly crafted, of books and music and theatre. Finally they spoke of power and money, and openly admitted their addictions to all these things. They held nothing back, and at one point Elsa regarded him solemnly. "It is too early to be absolutely certain, but I think that you and I will be good together." "I believe that also," he replied as gravely, and it was as though they had made a vow and a commitment. They danced in the balmy African nights. They laid their cheeks together, still hot and brown from the sun, and swayed to the beat of the steel band. After midnight, they at last climbed the broad stairway hand in hand to their suite and the wide, soft bed. "Good Lord," Sharza said with genuine amazement. "It's Thursday. We've been here for 4 days. The kids will be wondering what on earth's happened to us." They were at brunch on the open terrace. I think that they will guess. Elsa looked up from the mango she was peeling for him and smiled. And I don't think that kids is the correct description for that rumbustuous litter of yours. Van Veek will be arriving at Chisora tomorrow, Sharza pointed out.
I know, she sighed. I hate the thought of ending this. But we must be there to meet him.